For the other 20 pages of my Vita, you can go to my website. I was invited, I was a part of the early form of the Future Professori program. I'm a three-time loser at Syracuse. I bleed orange and a survivor of academic incest. And at the time, it was sort of put in a portfolio, and yay, that was good. So I'm glad to see it developed to this point. But it's interesting to look at the span from when I was doing that in the, early 90s to now, and talking about the future of the professoriate. It's interesting to put together a presentation because it's way too easy to turn it into one of these. Now, this may be a cultural reference that may not make sense to everyone, but these are the four horsemen of the apocalypse come to destroy the earth. Right, the idea of, well, you know, all the humanities, we no longer have the tenure-track faculty, and we see all of the economy, small colleges are closing, and everyone's getting rid of tenure, and pretty soon, through MOOCs and everything else, we'll just get rid of universities altogether. Good luck with that, right? You know, you're the future. Enjoy it. But I don't like that. That's not really my goal in life. I really am a activist researcher. Part of what I believe is that we determine our own future. I was doing a study, and the participant said, here's the question. The question is, what is the future of libraries? And so I would call up directors and such. I'd say, what is the future of libraries? And it was actually pretty funny, because I call up public libraries, and I'd say, what's the future of libraries? And they say, I can't tell you about academic libraries, because they're screwed. But we're going to be learning and education in social spaces. I said, okay, I call up an academic library director, and they say, I can't tell you about public libraries, because they're screwed. But we're going to be a learning and education in social center. And I just wanted to put the phone and say, excuse me, could you just have a moment? But in the process of this, actually a very smart doctoral student, David Pimentel, looked at me and says, that's the wrong question. He goes, do you want to know what is the future of libraries, or do you want to know what should be the future of libraries? If you're talking about is, it's like it's determined. It's coming this way. It's going to happen. All you get to do is sit back and enjoy the ride. But if you talk about what should be, it puts you in a much more affirmative, much more strategic way of thinking about it. And I think this is very much the truth with the future of the professoriate. I think looking at people here, we don't completely determine our future, but we determine a big chunk of it. And so a lot of what I want to talk about today is not things that are dooming us or things that you have to worry about. But I think opportunities that we can take advantage of as we begin to shape what higher education looks like tomorrow. Because I really firmly believe it's not going to look like it is today, and I think that's a good thing. A lot of people talk about the preservation of higher education, how we have this hundreds and hundreds of years of tradition, and back to the monks and sitting in the Renaissance. And the truth is, the reason we have higher education today is not because we haven't changed in 1,000 years, but because we change on a regular basis. If you look at the American form of higher education, it's radically different than the British model we supposedly based it on, because we didn't. We sold the Germans, right? And we industrialized it like we did our K-12 education. We started putting more and more people into it. We started creating professional advisors. This idea of reading and talking to me once a week over tea, that's craziness. What do we want it to be in the future, and how do we want it to look? I think that's for us to determine. And what I'd like to do is just talk about the year I've had in exploring some of what those changes may look like within our school. So my agenda for the day is to talk a little bit about technological enabled change, right? I work in the field of information studies, so of course everything in the world is about information, as we all know, and every industry is an information industry these days, so in case you were wondering, that's how we do it. But the truth is, we see technology changing lots of things. It is changing education. It's changing how we interact on a regular basis. It's changing how we socialize. It's changing how we build things. It's changing where we build things. And so we need to talk about how could we think that we're immune from that. Then I want to talk a little bit about the pressure for innovation, the different forms of it. Because a lot of the counter arguments to sort of this technologically enabled change in higher education miss the point. There's this assumption that we are this monolithic thing and you can't change us too quickly because we're too important. You need a degree to get a good job. So therefore, you need us to get a degree. It's a faulty form of logic, right? And finally, the need for change and in which way we do it. So here is the 500-pound gorilla in the room, quite literally, right? The MOOC, the massively open online course. And if you've been paying attention to the Chronicle of Higher Education or anything in higher education, you realize that this is putting you out of a job because 5 professors in Caltech will teach every course ever, as long as it's computer science and algorithms and you live in India. Right? But this idea that somehow we are going to change this storm, this has caught fire very quickly. But when you look at where it's caught fire in a very different... Some professors are very excited about this. But some professors aren't very excited about this. But a lot of the technology industry is very, very excited about this. Right? But this is only the latest. Right? We've, in the past 5 years, had the discussion of flipping the classroom. And that is not flipping off the classroom, which is, if you've taught to undergraduates, is a very tempting thing to do. I have to tell a story. So I was in the hospital in February, like 20 days. I was teaching via Skype, and I had someone bring all the papers in. And as part of being in the hospital, they would, on a regular basis, take your vitals, right? With your blood pressure, all this other stuff. So I had the cuff attached to it. So I took my vitals, and I started grading papers. And then 20 minutes later, just sort of out of the blue, it goes off. There's my vitals. My blood pressure had gone up like 20 points. And I'm convinced there's a paper in how undergraduates are bad for faculty health that we can write. So think about it. But flipping the classroom, right? The idea is that we no longer have to show up to classroom, or if we do, we shouldn't do this, right? Like, this is a radically new concept that somehow having someone stand in front of a room of passive people and blab on for 3 hours may not be the most effective way to teach. Duh, right? But now we can do it with YouTube, and so therefore it's radically different, right? Well, yeah, right? It turns out it's good teaching. What else? Licensed content, right? The idea that we can now teach 101 courses by buying the course. Not by getting, you know, the poor slave graduate student to go do it. Now we can just buy it, right? Or open textbooks. We no longer have to buy textbooks anymore. We can just open them up and everyone will write themselves. It'll be like Wikipedia for physics. This would be a scary thought. Anyway...
gluon clusters and bosons and, hey, my name's Bob.
You know, it could be fun. Right? But then the idea is that that's not enough. We need interactive textbooks and they need to spring to life and they're all going to be on our iPads and we're going to run around with them. We've done a lot of thinking about higher education and technological change. And what's amazing is we haven't done enough. Right? The fact that I can now walk into any classroom, even if it's out in Hamilton, Ohio, and assume that I have the ability to get on the internet and project something is radical departure from when I started. Right? When I started, it was like, do you have a projector? And they're like, slide? No! Right? We've changed. The fact that, and what's interesting is, you know,
yes, Dave, do the smartphone thing.
Yes, this has changed everything. But it has changed everything in ways that we didn't expect. This is the worst assumption you can make, is that people know what the hell this is and know how it works. And this is an assumption that we make almost in every classroom. We assume somehow if you've just come out of puberty, you've accepted the technology hormone, and it was raging with all the other ones, and you know how to use this. I cannot tell you, I'm in the School of Information Studies. We teach people in information management and technology. And you sit there and go, could you email me your paper? How? Really? Here's the hashtag for Twitter for the class. What's Twitter? We can't assume that technological change has happened in an equal basis. Or, as we know from looking after study, that everyone's had equal access to it. The truth is that for many people, this is the internet. This is how they access it. This is a radically different internet than if you access it on one of these. And we look at underserved populations that come into college, and we wonder, why is it that we sit them in front of these? They don't know how to use them. Or that they have these, that this is enough. You ever tried to write a dissertation on one of these? Don't do it. Right? The autocorrect alone would be worth doing the edits on a dissertation for this. But right. So we have dealt with technological change. And when we look at the MOOC world, right? So this is, someone did a wonderful infographic of the MOOC world, with Coursera and Khan Academy and Udacity and edX, and there are about 300 others. What's interesting about this graph is you kind of expect this list of universities that are playing in this space. And I cannot tell you what this list does in inspiring envy in every other college or university, and even though it's being recorded, including Syracuse University. We want to be part of it because they're part of it. We don't know why, we don't know what, but my God, we want to be part of it. The cool kids are all on edX. Where do we get them? Right. The scary one for me actually is Pearson's. The scary one for me, I mean, you know, Google, I mean, hell, Google does everything, right?
But, you know, I bought a gumball machine. Google just came out with Google gumballs, where you can put it into your phone and it will tell you the best way to chew it with earphones. I don't know.
Right? But, you know, some of these folks don't surprise us with venture capital, but these guys are very interesting, the venture capitalists, because they smell disruption. What we know in the technological world is where venture capital goes is where they see a massive disruption about to occur. They don't invest in eventual slow shifts and changes. They want to go where they can make a quick buck. And quick bucks come from rapid changes where players change hands. All right? So that's interesting. So we played around with this. I'll tell you a little bit about our experiments. We're in the middle of two MOOCs in the iSchool. The first one we did earlier in the semester, which was a data sciences MOOC. We had about 10,000 people sign up. Jeffrey Stanton, our associate dean and professor, taught it with a whole team of people, including academic support people, on what is data sciences. Right? Why did we do it? We did it for free. We didn't charge anyone. We used something called Course Sites, which is Blackboard's public world. Many jokes about Blackboard. Leave them alone for a moment. Right. Why did we do it? Well, because all the cool kids were doing it? Sure. The other thing we wanted to do is we wanted to get people to sign up to take, we have a certificate in data sciences. So this was our loss leader, right? You take this course, see how interesting it is, want a degree? Come to Syracuse for it. Better yet, we'll even knock off 3 credits of the degree you need to because you took this course. Right? Interesting model. Actually pretty successful in terms of getting the number of people. We'll see if it's successful in terms of getting anyone to actually pay for something in terms of tuition dollars. This one's happening this summer. This is mine and a group of other faculty. We're going to teach one in librarianship. We're hoping to get 2,000 people signed up. I will be amazed if we get 2,000 people signed up. But I'm all for it. And so we're going to try what, and why are we doing that? Reputation. We want people to think of us with advanced librarianship and what's going on. Once again, using the same infrastructure and how we did it. So we played this MOOC game. We'd love to play it more. But even there, we're experimenting. Right? Is the model to get people into what we do already? Is the model loss leaders for reputation? Is there revenue? One of the things we looked at with librarians is there's a whole class of school librarians. Some of you may have encountered them in high school and grade school. In New York State, they have to get continuing education units. That means they have to come on a regular basis and take classes to keep up with their field. Is this a revenue stream? Because we've always looked at 3-credit tuition dollars. Is there a way to do this with $100, $200 sessions versus $3,000 for a course? And if we do that, does it cut out the course? How do we figure out continuing education? So this is the sort of background that I went into thinking about. The other thing I'd like to point out, and if you don't know about this, it's brilliant. The Gartner Group put together what they call the hype cycle. So you've all, well, maybe not all, a lot of you have heard of Rogers' diffusion of innovation. It's this nice little bell chart. It talks about early innovators, people who basically do jump at anything that moves, right? So I'm a gadget freak. If it's got a battery, I want to buy it, right? Doesn't matter if it's useful. Doesn't matter if it's going to last anything. Right, I got a drawer full of stuff. My kids love going in and going, hey, let's play with this one if I can get it from all the wires that are tangled in. Right. Then there are you move from the innovators to the early adopters. These are the people that they're going to wait and they're going to buy the first MacBook Pro because once Apple does it, it's safe. But it's still cool because it's got an Apple book. Right? And then you've got sort of the major, the adopters, and then you've got laggards, and then you've got, you know, bums, and you've got people that you spit on the ground, Luddites, and anyway. Gartner looked at this and said, that's not right. That's this nice seamless move of technology. So what really happens is some technology gets invented. Google Glass, right? Then there's the peak of inflated expectation. Everyone's going to have one. And we're all going to walk around and somehow remember to turn them off when we go to the bathroom, right? And from everyone having a Google Glass, somehow we will feed starving children in Africa and disease will be wiped out, right? Then comes, and I love this one, the trough of disillusionment. Google Glass is a piece of crap. I wouldn't even give my mother one of these, and I hate her, right? This is a horrible piece of technology. Go away. And then through the slope of enlightenment, we sort of say, well, maybe I can use it to do this. Maybe I can use it to do that, right? Maybe it has a specific use. So, for example, before tablets became the thing that are replacing our laptops, Microsoft came out with these tablet PCs. They were more or less somewhat underpowered PCs, but you could write on them. It was very exciting. And in fact, Bill Gates got up, as Bill Gates does when he was the president, said, this will replace how we interact with computers forever and ever and ever. Like, because now you can work with your computer as if you're a 13th century monk. That's what we need. Right? They then sold two of them. One of them to me. Yeah, there you go. Still using it, right?
Yeah.
And then what happened is we realized that there actually are a few people that actually need to write on them. For example, when you're looking through papers and you need to say, this is the dumbest idea for a proposal I've ever seen, and then erase it so you can put something like, maybe work on your justification, right? Then we get this larger thing. So where we are with MOOCs is we're actually right about here with MOOCs. This was around the new year, where MOOCs were going to change higher education as we know them forever. And then everyone realized that, turns out, when you teach 10,000 people, you don't necessarily get the same interaction as when you teach 10. By the way, I am that professor who can't remember the 10 names at the same time. So that's right. Give me 10,000. It's all the same to me. That's correct. I have tenure. I'm a full professor. I am retired in place. Okay. So we're sort of going here. So for me, one of the epitomes, the two stories about MOOCs that really pointed this out to me was one, when a professor started a MOOC with, I believe it was edX, I may get that wrong, maybe Coursera, and it was on group dynamics, I love this, started teaching the course, and halfway through the course decided that this wasn't working out and quit the course. And the group that was offering the course kept going. In essence, the professor for this course said, not working, I'm stepping back. And the group that ran it said, that's fine, we'll staff it with, ready for this, graduate students, and keep it going. That was story number one that went, Story number two that went, is when the philosophy department, and you've got to leave, do I have any philosophers in the room? We can yell about epistemology later, because I suck at it. The philosophy department at San Jose State University was told that they need to use this social justice course that was put together by a Harvard professor, sort of a freshman-level social justice course. And they wrote a letter, look it up. It's a brilliantly well-written letter that more or less says, when we teach social justice, having someone at Harvard talk to a bunch of white kids that ask him questions about social justice with zero interaction and no connection to the students and so on, may not be the way to go. And then the professor at Harvard said, no, it isn't, and I never intended that to be the situation. That, to me, is an interesting turning point. Right? So this hype cycle is very interesting. So I'm going to talk a little bit about MOOCs, but I want to make one thing clear. When I talk about MOOCs, that's not the same thing as talking about online education. Teaching people at a distance, teaching people online, doing this virtually, is here to stay. One thing that is going to be very different from you entering the professoriate from me, actually not so much given where I entered, but anyway, was the assumption that whether you will teach using technology as your primary medium or whether you use the classroom as your primary medium, that's changed. And I think for the better. I think the idea of letting people learn certain topics at a distance, we've learned, it started with, they can only learn X, this little bitty thing, and we've gone to the point where it turns out you can teach a lot of stuff through technology. And turns out you can be high touch with technology. You can do real time. You can do video conferencing. You can use those pen-based computers to actually jot and do joint whiteboard stuff. That's different. So when I talk about MOOCs, this is not my way of saying online education isn't going to work. I think online education is brilliant and going to shape what you do. But that's different from what I see MOOCs are, which is giving a course with one professor teaching primarily a hierarchical traditional lecture model to 10,000 people around the world for zero money. I don't think that's the silver bullet we've been looking at for radical change in higher education. It would be a radical change. It would put us out of business. All right. Well, and it would put anyone out of business when you do it for free, right? Anyway, there's a focus problem when we talk about MOOCs. The first is it focuses exclusively on the teaching functions of higher education. When you look at the discussion of MOOCs, it's all about how we teach, which I welcome. We need to have a conversation of pedagogy. We need to have a conversation about the lecture format may not be the format of the future. There is a place for it, or I wouldn't be. Right? It's little focus, by the way, on learning. There's a huge discussion in how we deliver this. In other words, I'm a brilliant professor in topic XYZ. I put together lectures, I put together events and readings, and I deliver it to the world. The sage on the stage has spoken. What we have known for at least, do I have any folks in the education world? Since Dewey, and I don't mean Melville, right? But the idea, I know you said you're going, Melville, right? Libraries, education, we talk our Deweys, right? Is that that's not what we do. You don't teach people. You create opportunities for them to learn. You facilitate a learning process. It's an active process. And so you see, for example, a discussion of connectivism versus the traditional pedagogy. A lot of what's happening in the MOOC world is sage on the stage delivering instructions to the masses. A lot of what you see in the early development, if you sort of back up, was the idea of, you know something about this topic, you know something about this topic, you know something about it. Let's get together and share what we know about this topic in a much more participatory way. And that's almost all been completely wiped out because what we're looking for is the magic bullet where we don't have to spend any time in teaching, which as a professor is what we've been looking at for centuries, right? I want to be brilliant in my office. Oh, damn, it's time to teach. I walk down, I babble for a while, I leave, right? Now we can do it online. It was crap when I did it in my office. It's crap when you do it online. I hate to break it to you. It completely ignores labor issues. This is a really interesting concept. Right? I have a good friend, a colleague, who believes that the future is you find the smartest person on topic X, Y, or Z. They put together the content, the lectures. They're delivered around the country, and then what we get is good teachers who may not be content experts to work sort of with the students in incorporating and assimilating the information. Right? Interesting. I'm not sure it worked in 300-person classrooms with recitations, but let's try it again. It ignores completely the discovery aspects and the socialization aspects of higher education. Right? This is not about how to do massively collaborative online research. This is how to do delivery of instruction. And one thing that I think Syracuse has done very, very well over the past 20 years has been the integration of research and teaching. Right? We're talking about scholarship in action, which I'll talk about again, which was Nancy Cantor. But before that, Bud Shaw talked about an undergraduate research university. And what he meant was undergraduates don't get canceled out from the research and only graduate students get research. They all need to be involved. That was forward thinking at the time. I think it's still forward thinking, and I think it's very important. If we sort of look at this and say, it's just, IRED is just about teaching. And there are colleges that are just about teaching. But we totally ignore the rest of the aspects of higher education. We as a country will fail. My favorite line about higher education is that, and it was said with no sarcasm whatsoever, someone was in a presentation, Q&A session at Oxford, and they said, one of the great benefits of the university is that it can sustain an argument over time. And we're talking literally centuries. That we can debate what is the nature of man, what is the nature of knowledge, what is good, for centuries. You can't do that at Procter & Gamble because they sit and look at it and goes, no, what is the nature of selling to man tomorrow, right? That kind of place where we have set aside the ability to think not only practically but very esoterically, very largely, where do we put that? How do we monetize it? I was just in Patricia's session before where she was talking about grants and such. Grants are great, but even there's a trend to what is the outcome. More and more today, particularly at the federal level, there is deliverable. I was at Bill Arms, who was at Cornell, once talking about getting SF grants, and he said, we titled this one, maybe we'll at least have one deliverable out of this one, right? This idea of serendipity, where do we put it? All right. So are we ripe for innovation? In other words, should we look at higher education and say, it's fine, let's leave it alone. In other words, should you, as the future of the professoriate, basically sit back and relax? No. Why? This is a very interesting graph. It talks about percent of adults with at least a high school diploma by age group. And there's two age groups, right? You see the wonderful green and you see the red, right? The green is 25 to 34. The red is their parents 45 to 54. And by country. So this is Korea. Korea has the most educated, at least high school level, young people. And look at the dramatic rise they had over a generation, right? Clearly, this was a situation where Korea said, this is a priority. We need to educate. High school is important. Let's do it. Right? You would expect the next ones, Norway, Japan, Slovenia. Can anyone pick out the very interesting aberrant data point? Look at the red box. It's above the green box. This is the first time where the generation has slipped in high school performance in the U.S. The younger generation has fewer degrees than their parents. Now, it's not a lot, and frankly, we were pretty high anyway. But it's an interesting trend to watch. And it's an interesting, particularly when we talk about moving to a service and information economy, where a college degree is seen as the minimal form, where we've seen the decimation of vocational education and non-college career opportunities at the primary and secondary level. We've created a situation where it's harder to get these degrees. They're more about standardized testing, about regurgitation than actual thinking skills. And at the same time, we're getting fewer of it and they have fewer opportunities without the degrees. That's a recipe for what we call the four horsemen of the apocalypse again. Now, this is not the only reason, right? This is high school. We expect them to screw up. Right? This is like right when we get master's students who can't write, we yell at the undergraduate degree, and when the undergraduates can't write, we yell at the high school teachers, and the high schools blame the middle schools blame grade school, and then somewhere there's a sort of neonatal reading course that someone didn't take. This is one problem. But this, to me, is a much more fundamental problem and why those venture capitalists are licking their lips, which is not the right button. What happened? I had a button. It did wrong things. Let's see if I can do this again. There we go. And that's this. This shows the percentage of increase in different things, in how the cost of different things. So, for example, the consumer price index from 1982 to 2007 went up by approximately 100%. So it's about twice as expensive to buy something as it was in 87. This is the median family income. It's kept pace. My guess is if we look at those statistics, they probably wouldn't be so cheery today. Medical care, outrageous medical expenses have gone up 250%. College tuition has gone up 450%. This is unsustainable. 2 years ago was the first year in the United States where more people had more debt in academic debt than credit card debt. People owed more money for their education at the higher ed level than they did on their frivolous spending of like the ShamWow. Right? And it wasn't because people were suddenly much better about paying back their credit cards. Now, you have lots of things you can blame for this. You can blame basically cheap money from the federal government. You can blame increased administration from higher ed. You can blame lots of stuff, but the point is, this is an unsustainable trend. Right? This is not only an unsustainable trend, I would argue this is an unethical trend. That in essence we are burdening the next population where they have to get their education with the amount of tuition they can never pay back because of their education. That's immoral. All right. So we're ripe for innovation. Now's the time. Now, the other thing is you go, all right, so great, we're ripe for innovation. But the truth is, as Dave, you said, you can't do teaching without research. You can't do research without this. You can't. How would you replicate higher education? It's taken us a couple thousand years to get here. We wear our hoods, we wear our maces, we figured it all out. How would you do that overnight? Well, it turns out that innovation works in a couple of different ways. One is brand new thoughts, right? Bing, never thought about this, brand new thing, iPad. No one thought the tablet was a brand new market sector. Here it is, boom, we all buy, right? But there's another form which is much more consistent, and it's innovation through segmentation. I'm going to give you a technology industry version of this. So IBM owned the computer market in the 50s and 60s and 70s and most of the 80s. Owned it outright. Right? So IBM looked at all their competitors who tried to own it outright, and they laughed. They said, good luck building a computer. Right? First of all, it's as big as a house. Secondly, it takes a couple $1 million. Thirdly, can like add four numbers, right? You're never going to do it. You don't have the sales force. It's never going to happen. Hilarious. And then Bill Gates and Paul Allen go to work for IBM. They actually don't work for IBM, but they come to them and say, we're going to build the operating system for your personal computers. IBM says, fine, personal computers, go ahead. They said, but only if we get to own it. And IBM said, enjoy. Because to them, owning the operating system was completely irrelevant. It's like walking around, with this wonderful idea, but you don't have a computer to run it on, doesn't matter. But what Bill Gates saw and what Microsoft became was they saw that with personal computers, anyone could begin to build them. Technology was going to come to point. And so what became suddenly what was never an industry before, the operating system industry, became a bigger industry than the computing industry as IBM defined it. Now, great, this is done. So then these little scrappy people come around and they see this thing called the Internet and they say, we're going to build a browser. They called them Netscape. And Microsoft laughed and laughed and laughed. Bill Gates famously said, the Internet doesn't matter. That in essence, you're going to do PowerPoint and maybe there's an Internet to download Clippy the Clip Art, but really, that's about it. Marc Andreessen and company said, oh no, this is going to be the predominant way we do it. They go public, they make a huge amount of money, Microsoft comes out, the browser wars begin. Then this little two crazy doctoral students, who I don't think ever finished in Stanford, said, then the browsers are irrelevant. It's search that matters. There's so many browsers, there's so many sites out there that you can have a browser, but you're never going to remember and bookmark them all. Yahoo. So really, search is the next industry, to which Netscape said, we'll put a search box, but it doesn't matter. Now, I love teaching students because they come in and they talk about Google as if it's existed for millions and millions of years. Right? Well, what are you going to do? I'm going to develop an app. Really? That could be bigger than Google. Nothing can be bigger than Google. 5 years ago, anything was bigger than Google. Right? You know? The point is, we look at higher education and you sit there and go, nothing can break up higher education because we take the youth and we educate them. And maybe you can say, well, the components are teaching and research. But how are you going to break those up? But if you look at higher education with much more fidelity, you see there's a lot more that can be broken up. For example, how about housing? That socialization issue. Right? So everyone's a Syracuse student. Do you ever eat in Ernie Davis Hall? Do you know who owns Ernie Davis Hall? It's not Syracuse University. It's a private company that that leases the land from SU. Yes, you can. Turns out. I didn't know either. But I know. You see this all the time where universities are looking for greater housing. Some universities like OCC and ESF, they're building their own, but a lot of them are outsourcing the housing function of the university. Look at sports programs. How much of that's outsourced? We begin to see this idea that you really can begin to break the university up into much finer chunks and innovate on these finer chunks, and things happen. Now, what happens? First of all, we see that when this has been tried, MOOCs are the current one, but actually the private universities to me are much more interesting. Phoenix University is a much more interesting case study of disruption in higher education. Now, why are we no longer worried about Phoenix University? Because you don't hear, ooh, Phoenix is going to kill us. You used to hear that. Number one, because universities are excellent lobbyists who managed to put some wonderful crippling legislation on them. Number two, they went after the same model as they, in essence, replicated the higher education's not-for-profit model, and they went after federal dollars, period. So as federal dollars start to dry up, which they are drying up, Phoenix University and the private universities begin to dry up. And they don't have much differentiation between the not-for-profits. Corporate universities. This idea that you go back for your master's in engineering, you go back for your master's in computer science, you go back to your master's in computer science, these days people laugh at you. Why? I'm going to go to this training program. I'm going to learn it online. I'm going to get this book. I'm going to teach it. Microsoft certifies us. Google's going to certify us, etc. These are interesting disruptive models. And in the university side, we see major disruption coming up. Not necessarily to the university, but open access is a major disruptive force. The days when you published in a journal and gave away your intellectual property without second thought is going away. Now, what's very interesting is when you go to publish in a journal, there's actually peer pressure for people going, did you sign away your copyright? Are you okay with that? Is that ethical? They're going to sell it back to your university at huge amounts of money. You're giving away the intellectual property. This is a radical disruptive force going on in scholarly communication. Also, when you look at the idea of data sciences, Google understands more about how to crunch data than mathematicians at an academic department at times. How are we going to look at these sort of industry-built research sectors? So We have things that can be chunked up. So what I'm going to argue is the major disruption, the major change we need to make has nothing to do with MOOCs. It has nothing to do with how we're going to do our residence hall. But there will be a major change. And the major change looks like this. The top line is the existing sort of how we think about higher education. And that is in degrees. And those degrees are almost always situated at the beginning of a career. In essence, if you want to be an engineer, you come before you're an engineer and you get your degree and you become an engineer. And then you go do your career. And maybe when you're ready to move out of the day-to-day calculations and drafting, you come get your master's so you can move into a management position. But in essence, you come at the beginning of your management position and progress forward. And then eventually you get tired of it and you want to become a professor. You come, you get your doctorate at the beginning of becoming a professor and you move forward. So what we do is we stamp things at the beginning of time with these big, enormous, cumbersome accrediting processes. It takes 4 years. And in 4 years, we're going to teach you everything you ever needed to know about being X. I think this is hilarious. I teach librarians. Now, you may have a stereotype of a librarian. They're very cool people. And this idea that somehow I can, in 2 years, teach them everything they need to know to be a librarian for the rest of their lives is hilarious. They're going to go from manning reference desks and shelving books and searching online databases to managing multi-million dollar corporate and civic organizations, all with what I teach them at the beginning of their career. I can't even remember the beginning of this presentation, right? Much less how to do accounting. What we're seeing is going on that this education is also tends to be around theory. And you see a lot of my fellow colleagues who will look at you and make a very, very, very sharp line between education and training. Education and career preparation. We don't do career preparation, right? It's like law school. Many law school curriculums, many lawyers, many law school teach about the sort of theory and sense of the Constitution and law, and then you go study the bar, which is the laws there, right? Which is minor, right? Just memorizing like that many books, right? But we don't do that in medicine, right? In medicine, we don't go, this is the sort of organ system, blood goes through, good luck, right? We do something very different in medicine. And so what you see is these different models from theory and practice. And we see some of it in the diversity in higher education as well, but a lot of it's up here. What's going on here is when you're in a career may be too, when you're in a life, because it may be defined by your career, but it may be defined by what do you want to do today. Maybe you want to go and become an artist, or a nurse, or whatever. You want to do it not just because of the money, but because you're fulfilling life. I get it. But you're continuously learning. Continuously learning. You run across gaps in your knowledge all the time. You fill them. Maybe it's a class. More often than not, it's something you read online, have a conversation, get a job and learn it on the job, all these things. What we need to see, and what needs to be, I would argue, the major shift, is that we need to look at higher education at this level. We need to look at continuous learning. This isn't the idea of alumni perks. They come through, they're alumni, we offer them a class or two. This is saying, I'm going to invest in you at the beginning of your career, and I'm going to be here throughout your career to make sure that you're prepared and trained as you move forward. And that means that not only do you need to know the theory, you need to know the practice as well. And it's going to vary. At undergraduate level, very practical. At the master's level, less practical. But a lot of, and at the doctoral level, we don't even know what practical is. Right? I used to have discussions. There's sort of the information library science camp of Europe and the information library science camp of the U.S. And it's like, you know, their theory and talking to Habermas and all this other stuff. And we're not even practical. We're like guerrilla warfare. We're mercenary about how we look at this. Somewhere in the Canary Islands, I think we find the right mix. But we need to think about the idea of higher education being continuous education. The idea that, yes, we live in a world where the jobs, if you want to define it by marketplace, but even the circumstances of life change continuously. And you need to, as a citizen, be continuously informed about that. I mean, take it out of the job world. Take it into the informed citizenry. One of the things that I think higher education often underplays is its role in civic engagement. That we are good for democracy. that we prepare people to engage and govern themselves. Okay, how? And after they get out, and after we give them all the verb and vimmer and get them all the reading Alinsky and everything else, and we send them out in the world, how do we engage them and continuously challenge them in that world? How do we tap into them and say, how did you change the world today? How did you change the world today? Because we've known for a long time that the other problem with MOOCs is they define things wrong. They define the world by consumer and producer. That as a student, you consume. And as a professor, you produce. I produce education and you consume it. This is crap. We see it in the markets. We see it in technological markets. So yes, we'll bring up the wonderful smartphone again. I'm an Apple user. Great. I wrote an app for Android that's exactly what you need. Can't use it. Why? Because you're a consumer and you're in my marketplace and I am going to control the marketplace. And I'm not going to let bad stuff in and I get to define what bad stuff is. Walled gardens of technology. Are we creating walled gardens of higher education? You can't get in to participate fully in society because you don't have enough money, you don't have the right background, you don't have the right test scores. What is it that we really want to do? Do we want to be, as we've argued in the past, continuous engines of innovation for a marketplace, but also continuous engines of leadership? We prepare the next generation of leaders. And if we do that, do we ethically do it through exclusion? Only those people can afford it. Only those people who read and think the right way. How do we bring it in? What we need to ultimately look at reshaping higher education is around becoming more agile, more continuous. Some baby steps. This is based on my own school, but based on other things that have happened at other universities. Professional schools have sort of had to think about this before, right? What's great is the chip on our shoulder has now become a trophy. Right? The chip on our shoulder was, oh, you're a professional school. I'm a physicist. Right? Oh, you're in the social sciences. How quaint. Right? Any physicists in the room that I'm continually offending, I'm sorry. But the idea is now we look at professional education as something that, yes, there is rigor to it. There is academic rigor to it. But being tied into the profession actually gives us great benefit in this current market environment. We get up... It was kind of funny when we tried this the first time. We got up and said, we're the internet school. And this was right, we're the dot-com school. Now, some of you may remember the dot-com. That was the era that ended with, like, the whole market crash. And everyone said, you know, why are we paying billions of dollars to Netscape when they're not selling anything? Maybe that's not the best idea. So that whole marketing strategy kind of went in the trash bin. Then we became the school that was training people to be outsourced. That wasn't so nice. Then it was, now we're the internet innovation. It's cool to be innovators again. We've created professors of practice. This is not adjuncts. So my colleagues, Jill Hurst-Wall, one of my colleagues, Art Thomas, one of my colleagues, David Dushabi, who just won one of the Meredith Professor Awards, are not on the tenure track. But they're full-time, invested, part of our personnel policy, have a career track, have leaves available to them, faculty. And they come to faculty meetings and they vote as it is. So it's not like we have the gown in these other folks. This is not, oh, here's $10 to teach every history major ever. This is creating an agile workforce where we take pride. Maybe you're not doing mixed methods with X validity, but you have an understanding of the profession that I don't have because you're in it or you're from it. And that gets respected. Virtual faculty. We have faculty who don't come to Syracuse. But that's all right because these days, they still come to faculty meetings. We have them. They're like little heads that just sort of float in the corner. They can teach online. They can live wherever they want. And if they're professors of practice, they can live where they're doing their practice so they don't interrupt that cycle of learning and applying and learning and applying. We see consortial research. I was just at Trish's session. Did a great job. Clearly, the emphasis was on established grant programs. What we're finding is happening is you say, this group of companies, people, industries, libraries, in my case, want X question answered. We're going to bring them together and everyone's going to put a little money into the pot and then we're going to do the research. The last thing you ever write is the proposal. It's a very different model than someone's determined that there's the price line, come get it, to this is what we need, how do we support it? Online teaching infrastructure. The idea that online is now essential. And what's very interesting is the integration of curriculum into research. This is one of our fundamental structural problems. You will be hired as a professor because you are brilliant in topic X. You will be asked to teach topic Z. No, that's too far down in the alphabet. You will be asked to teach topic A. Right? You are a biologist who understands the effect of carbon infusion into the ocean on plant life and coral construction. You're teaching biology 101 next semester. Are you the best person to teach it? Do you care about teaching it? And better yet, if you understand corals, and we talked about there was a climate change question before. Here's the trick with climate change. To convince people, you don't show them your statistics. You show them the impact. And sometimes that means you have to educate them. And educate them doesn't just mean yell at them till they give up. I've tried. I'm doing that now. Right? Education, we understand, comes from the idea of taking them from where they are, what they know, how they see the world, to where you want them to be. And here's the trick. They'll never get there. They never will. Because education exists and knowledge exists only in here. I can't turn you into me on a topic. I can tell you what I know, but you're going to take it and internalize it and make your own out of it. But what we're talking about is if we can begin to integrate the messaging and social media and outreach, curriculum, teaching, and learning, with the discovery and research and knowledge aspects, we have a much better way of convincing funders. We have a much better way of making the world better, little thing. We have a much better way of making a better impact for our careers, good thing. One of the things is you've seen, or maybe you haven't seen, the decimation of the academic press. Every major university used to have an academic press. They knew a topic. They usually had a topic. They would go and they would publish in that area and get well known. It wasn't just the idea that they only published their own professors. They would get a topic that they were sort of good at. Gone. Gone. If they're not out of business, they're absorbed somewhere and they're a minor organization right now. What we're seeing is the advent of a new academic press. But rather than that academic press being publishing and shooting out books, it's publishing and shooting out MOOCs, publishing short courses, webinars, bringing and building consortia of people in the world who care about your ideas and want to be part of those ideas. Right? We're seeing this in the rise of self-publications. Right now, books, depends on the field, right? So if you're in philosophy, if you're in some of the humanities, you write a book, that's your tenure. In other fields like mine, you write a book, that's your wasted time. Yeah, we want journal articles, right? And I'm in the middle of cancer treatment, just looking for sympathy. But as I got it, it turns out I have a very rare presentation, right? I have Hodgkin's lymphoma, great cancer to get. I highly recommend it if you have to get one. But it turns out that in my biopsy, it has all these things called granulomas in it. I know you're really terribly intrigued. Granulomas are when your immune system finds something it doesn't know what to do with, it can't kill. Sort of bundles it up and chunks it into a cell. I don't know why. I got lots of them. So I hear this. And, of course, being the guy I am, I'm going to go online to scare the hell out of myself and find out what that means. And I find all these articles on granulomas in biopsies. And, by the way, the short answer is academically terribly interesting, clinically irrelevant. Good news. But the articles are like three paragraphs long. Right? They're you know, 42-year-old male presented with lots of granulomas and didn't die. You know, great. So I'm going to be an article someday. But I sat there with three paragraphs long. That's an article that counts? Right? Every field's going to be different. But what we do know is that at least in a lot of the professional fields, we're looking to self-publish our books now. Why? Peer review of a book is radically different than peer review of a journal article. Peer review of a book starts at the beginning before you write it. It's kind of like, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Very different than sort of statistical, did you get it all right? So it doesn't have the same play. We can now, I have a colleague who wrote a book on theory development. Everyone said, oh, we don't have time, we don't have a course, that won't sell as a textbook. Once again, something else you don't hear from journal folks, because they assume they're going to sell everything for lots of money. So what she did is she published her own. Why not? And that data sciences course, Jeff Stanton taught it, published an open source textbook. He's already got his tenure, didn't have to worry about it, but now everyone contributing can begin to use writing a book to building a group of support, talking to potential funders, talking to potential academics, and teaching the importance of what he cares about. Very different world. I mean, the different world is ivory tower. It doesn't exist anymore. Right? We're participants in a society that's having a conversation about what is better and how it's governed. We need to be part of that conversation. We have far to go.
we have to break the three-credit tyranny. This idea that a course is 3 credits, do you know where 3 credits came from? It came from a labor action with the Carnegie Foundation for reimbursement. It was never, never a measure of content. And yet, what have we done? We've turned it into, it's a measure of content that's 14 weeks long with X number of contact hours. And that's the best way to teach everything, apparently. Why? Why not 1 credit? Why not half credit? Why not 0.2 credits? Why not 50 credits? Why not? And we have to go to the departmental committee, to go to the school committee, to go to the faculty senate, to go to the state, to get the approval for the... Why? What do you do with something that's radically new that you need to teach today? What do you do when that massive innovation happens that totally changes the worldview of your field? Wait 6 months to 9 months to 10 months to teach it? Or start teaching it today? More diverse faculty, and I don't only mean that in the form of faculty practice. Why not that thing that changed the whole world today, and it turns out it's the 18-year-old freshman who knows it best? Have the 18-year-old freshman teach it and make the faculty show up. Why not? Why aren't we moving to the idea that we look at this whole college, we look at the professoriate as a participatory learning center that fuses research and teaching, that fuses theory and practice, and fuses the concept of student and faculty? If you're not a student when you get your first job as a professor, you are a shitty professor, pardon my language. If you don't seek to learn, if you don't seek to explore, if you don't seek to know something new, you are failing as a professor. Your field, your job does not stop at the dissertation, and it doesn't stop at tenure. Continuously learning, integrating, understanding, changing, shaping, and making the world a better place, that's your job. And the students are there to help you, not simply watch in awe and amazement. The staff is there to help you, not simply service it with copying. Sponsored program is not there as a checklist to say what you've done wrong. They're there to help you get the resources to do it. We have to look at that college in this system, because if we don't, if we say, no, higher education is fine, it's defined as research and teaching and housing and that's it, people will chip away and chip away and chip away. And they should, because our relevance will become less and less and less. So I don't see 4 horsemen of the apocalypse in your future, but only if you take control of that future. Only if you seek to understand how to make the world a better place and have an impact, and not worry about numbers of publications and how fast they come out, and not worry about how to get the grading done in the fastest, most efficient way, but worry about, did someone actually know what they're talking about when they come out of my class? That's what we need to be involved in. That's the major change. MOOCs? They'll come and go. We'll call them something different next year. Online education, it's just education now. We don't break it out. This idea of an active, engaged learner who also engages the rest of the community in their learning process, that's the future of the professor. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.